good advice and pointed to the right choice. But I'm determined to set out to Mecca. For this purpose, my followers, nephews, brothers, and I have got ready. The decision is mine. The decision is mine and the opinion is mine. However, you are not like them in this regard. You are supposed to stay in Medina so as to remain my eye and my reporter over them, the Umayyad agents. You shouldn't hide any one of the activities from me. It indicates that, I mean, these words of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam indicate that Muhammad ibn al-Hanafi was a true well-wisher for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Yet, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam was determined to have at least one confident person in Medina in order to report to him the latest updates about the situation in Medina. Now we find that in another dialect, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam indicated it in this way to his stepbrother Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyya. Oh brother, if there wouldn't be any shelter or place of refuge in the world, I would never take the oath of allegiance with Yazid ibn Muawiyah. So we find that according to a precise words of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, he was determined, he was resolute not to recognize Yazid ibn Muawiyah, because Yazid ibn Muawiyah wasn't the right person to assume that important and critical post of rulership of Muslims. In addition, we find that the current of usurping the rights of the Ahl al-Bayt started right after the demise of the Prophet Muhammad at Saqifah. So we find that a divergent line started, and the coming of Muawiyah, and especially the coming of Yazid ibn Muawiyah, could be regarded as a sinister continuation of that divergent line. Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam was the most appropriate personality for assuming rulership. Hence, it was expected of him not to recognize Yazid ibn Muawiyah, and indeed, he acted in this way.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Brother Hasnain Rajab Ali.
I begin in Allah's name, the Beneficent, the Merciful, and all praise belongs to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Yazid, as soon as he came into power, sent a messenger to Walid, who was the governor of Medina, and told him immediately, get the allegiance of Hussein ibn Ali, and if he refuses, behead him. And Walid tried to do that, but the Imam prevented him, and Imam leaves the vicinity. And then he asks for one night by which to consider this demand that Yazid put. And in secrecy, Imam packs up with his family, visits the grave of the Holy Prophet, as we mentioned, and he aims towards Mecca. While in Mecca, Yazid sends all kinds of spies to try to kill Imam Hussein. But before Imam Hussein alayhi salam leaves Medina to go to Mecca, he leaves a will. He leaves behind Muhammad bin Hanafiya, who was his brother, and he leaves behind a will. And I'd like to describe the essence of this will. Imam Hussein alayhi salam says, هذا ما أوصى به الحسين بن علي إلى أخي محمد بن حنفية أن الحسين يشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له وأن محمدا عبده ورسوله جاء بالحق من عنده وأن الجنة حق والنار حق والنار حق والساعة آتية لا ريب فيها وأن الله يبعث من في القبور. Look how Imam is now describing his will. He's laying the foundation of usul, that I believe, I Hussein bear witness there is no God but one. I bear witness. And that God is one, and you cannot associate anything. Tawheed. And that the Holy Prophet is the servant of Allah, and he is the messenger of Allah. And it is the truth, and it is with them. And Allah has made truth through them. And that paradise is true, and hell is true, and the day of judgment is true, and I have no doubt in it. وَأَنَّ اللَّهَ يَبْعَثُ مَنْ فِي الْقُبُورِ. Then Imam Hussein alayhi salam beautifully describes. He says, وَأَنِّي لَمْ أَخْرُجْ أَشْرًا وَلَا بَطِرًا وَلَا مُفْسِدًا وَلَا ظَالِمًا وَإِنَّمَا خَرَجْتُ لِطَلَبِ الْإِصْلَاحِ فِي أُمَّةِ جَدِّي صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَآلِهِ أريد أن آمر بالمعروف وأنهى عن المنكر وأسير بسيرة جدي وأبي علي بن أبي طالب. How beautiful, and I'll describe this. فمن قبلني بقبول الحق فالله أولى بالحق ومن رد علي هذا أصبر حتى يقضي الله بيني وبين القوم وهو خير الحاكمين. Beautiful description of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, where he says that in this movement of mine is not on account of stubbornness, not on account of rebellion, not on account of worldly passions or instigation by shaitan. It is not my object to create trouble or to oppress anyone. The only thing which invites me to this great movement is that I should reform the affairs of the followers of my grandfather and eradicate corruption like racism, like thievery, like cheating, like lying, like debauchery, like immorality. Undertake enjoining to do good and restraining from evil, and to follow the tradition of my grandfather, the Prophet of Allah, and my father, Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salatu wasalam. He says, I have come to reform the followers of my grandfather. If the people reform to my call, this is very important, and I will recite, inshallah, in the subsequent nights, Surah Saf. You will see the entire surah is with reference to this. The Imam says, if the people respond to my call and they accept the truth of me, well and good. And if they don't accept it, I shall observe patience. And here's an interesting point. He says, I am not afraid of unpleasant events, hardships, and sufferings. Why? Because the Imam has sacrificed himself towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. When Imam arrives in this land, after he travels, he meets Hur, and he arrives in this land where his horse is refusing to move, the camels are refusing to move. And as you know, as he leaves Mecca, first of all, he meets Farazdak. Farazdak was a famous poet coming from Kufa. And Imam says, what is the status? He says, their tongues are towards you, but their swords are towards Yazid ibn Muawiyah, towards the Umayyads. And Imam says, Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. What you say is correct. What you say is correct. But I will continue to move unafraid. And I will go towards my destiny. And as the Imam arrives in this land and the horses are not moving, he asks the people, what is this plant? What is this plane called? They say, Nainawa. He said, what are the name? Then they tell him it's Karbala. And Imam says, Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. He says, now I have reached my destination. This place is where my grandfather told me that a great event shall take place and my sacrifice shall take place on this land. And the Imam calls and finds out who are the owners of this land. The clarity by which the Imam is going to take with which to establish the clarity of truth against falsehood, good against evil, is to such a level that the Imam is also purchasing the land upon which he will become massacred, and his family will become massacred, and the companions, the close ones, the 72, who will become massacred on this land. And the Banu Asad come forward and they say that we are the owners of this land. The Imam purchases it. And after purchasing it, he said, I have a request from you. This was, by the way, the second day after, in other words, the second of Muharram. And as the Imam is purchasing this land, the people of the Banu Asad are curious to know why the Imam is purchasing this land. And he says to them that soon, a tragic event shall take place and you will see much injustice done. He said, but I give this land back to you after purchasing it. But I have one request that I wish for you to fulfill. And that request is that when you do see bodies strewn on this barren land, beheaded, bleeding, without limbs. Imam Hussein alayhi salam's body was crushed. They say 40 horses came and trampled his body. They beheaded his blessed body, put it on a spear. Zainab alayhi salam sees that. And she says, curse be upon you, Umar ibn Sa'd, who was the commander of that army, who committed this heinous crime under the command of Ibn Ziyad. As you know, Ibn Ziyad was known as Ibn Marjana. Marjana was the name of his mother. These evildoers, and why was he called the son of his mother? Because she was such a wicked woman that nobody knows who his real father is. These are the kinds of people who cornered Imam Hussein. Suffice it to say, within the time that I have tonight, that the Imam asks the people of Karbala that please cover our bodies, for the enemies will not do that. This is the kind of tragedy that will take place. Cover our bodies. And if you cannot, and if you don't have time, and if you're unable to do it, then have your children come and take the sand like they're playing with it and cover our bodies, for there will be no one to care for us. And Imam Zainul Abidin, who was aware of this, standing next to his father. Ali Akbar, standing there next to his father, watching this conversation take place, is truly, truly a travesty in history. Ala la'natullahi lal-qawm al-zalimeen. Wa sayya'lamu alladhina zalamu ayyamun qalabin yanqalibun.
The moon of Muharram, times of sadness have come. The crescent has now arrived, casting gloom on Karbala, casting gloom on Karbala. The moon of Muharram, times of sadness have come. The crescent has now arrived, casting gloom on Karbala, casting gloom on Karbala, casting gloom on Karbala.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره، همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام يا ابن آدم لا تحمل هم يومك الذي لم يأتك على يومك الذي قد أتاك، فإنه إن يك من عمرك يأتي الله فيه برزقك.
Imam Ali said, O son of Adam, do not inflict the worry of the day that has not yet come on the day which has already come. Because if that day be in your life, Allah will bestow its livelihood as well. Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. Dear friends, one of the beautiful lessons which we learn from the truly universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is to live a simple life. Now, it is very clearly found in the historical texts as well as the books of tradition and even the tafsir, the extrapolation or the exegesis of the Holy Quran. We find that it is commonly found that Imam Ali alayhi salam, he wore coarse garments, rough clothes, for example, clothes made out of wool or these kind of coarse, rough, hard, difficult clothing. But interestingly, it was pleasant for him. This, even though it is a very small or seemingly insignificant hardship to bear, but still it is a hardship. It's interesting, one of the things that is haram for men to wear is silk, and if you will see that silk is very soft and very expensive. But Imam Ali alayhi salam, he teaches us something radically different. Not only does he wear clothing which is rough, meaning clothing which is uncomfortable to wear, he is actually pleased at this idea. He is pleased at wearing these rough clothing. Now, one of the things, of course, usually this kind of rough clothing is less expensive. It is a clothing which the common people, at least to a certain extent, wear. And if not the common people, then at least the poor people wore these kind of clothes. And another thing which is a beautiful thing hidden within this wearing of rough clothes is the fact that it is a hardship put upon the physical body and the soul, in a sense where it does not allow the body and the soul to enjoy these kind of physical pleasures. Now, of course, we're not saying here that everybody needs to start dressing like the poor, but in the least, we should stop dressing like the super rich and famous. Why do we spend countless, you know, tens of hundreds of dollars or euros or pounds or whatever it is on shoes and clothes and shirts and jeans and what? We spend all this money just on clothing, where Imam Ali alayhi salam is telling us, wear clothing which is proper, is clean. But it doesn't need to be expensive. It doesn't need to be extravagant. Rather, keep it simple. A profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
يوم لا ينفع مال ولا بنون Allah, I ask you for the protection of the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil. And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, "Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger." And I ask you for protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet. Ask you for protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
A leader does admonishment. And if they are sometimes angry with their followers, it doesn't mean he's condemning them. Basically, a sincere leader will always look for the betterment of his community. Whenever he sees weaknesses, he will talk about it. What is Amr bil Ma'ruf and Nahy al Munkar? Wherever he will find weakness in his own followers, he will talk to them. That, well, this is the problem with you, better, you know, change yourself. This is not only Ali, this is actually the sunnah of Rasulullah himself. And even the sunnah of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Just two examples. Look at Surah Jumu'ah. The last ayat of Surah Jumu'ah is very interesting. Well, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَإِذَا رَأَوْا تِجَارَةً أَوْ لَحْوًا انْفَضُّوا إِلَيْهَا وَتَرَكُوكَ قَائِمًا. What does it mean? What is this ayah saying? We repeat it every Friday. It is actually a reminder. The Rasul is in Nabi, Masjid al-Nabi, in Medina. It is the time of Jummah khutbah. And who are there? Mushrikeen? No. They are all Muslimin, not only Muslimin, because they see Rasulullah, all of them by definition are Sahaba. And what happens one day? A trade caravan happened to come into the city of Medina right at the time when Rasulullah was giving his khutbah of Jummah. And when they used to come, they actually used to have their drum to announce that we are here so people can, customers can come and buy their goods. And on that moment, what happened? Majority of these Muslims abandoned Rasulullah. And this is not history. This is not a Shia book. This is the book of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. وَإِذَا رَأَوْا. And when they saw تِجَارَةً أَوْ لَحْوًا, business opportunity or entertainment, انْفَضُّوا إِلَيْهَا, they converge towards it. وَتَرَكُوكَ قَائِمًا, and they left you, O Muhammad, standing on the member giving your khutbah of Jummah. Now you want to tell me that just because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala became disappointed with the Sahaba here, so they all are gone? So this admonishment, you know, wa'az and nasiha, doesn't mean that this is a basis for condemning the Shia community from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali bin Abi Talib alayhi salatu wasalam.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Ministry.
The explosion that shook our city of Beirut a year ago was something we have never seen in any Hollywood movie. I don't know of it if it's possible to make such a scene in even an animated movie either. I give only one piece of information to explain the horror of the incident. The quivering of this explosion was a 3.5 on the Richter scale. 218 people were killed in the blast of Beirut, a few of whom were on ground zero at the time of the explosion were never found. More than 7,000 were injured, and more than 300,000 people became instantly homeless. People from around the world expressed their sorrow at the suddenness of the incident, but the first punch was thrown by former U.S. President Donald Trump. In a briefing at the White House shortly after the incident, he claimed that the explosion was a massive bomb attack. This raised a whole lot of questions for everyone as to who might have done it, how, and most importantly, why. On the other hand, the Lebanese government claims since the beginning of the incident that more than 2,700 tons of ammonium nitrate were stored in the warehouse where the incident took place at the seaport. This made every one of us wonder why this huge amount of ammonium has been stored in a densely populated area since 2014. The fact so far is that the ammonium was recovered from a ship brought in illegally and stored in a warehouse at the seaport since 2014, and a whole lot of officials knew about it, including heads of state, prime ministers, and even, or rather mainly, the commander-in-chief of the Lebanese armed forces. The atrocity encapsulated everything that is rotten about Lebanon's governing system. The rampant corruption, the incompetent inaction, a system held hostage by a foreign power whose potence to be Lebanese defenders shattered this nation many times over. And last but not least, our eternal enemy, Israel, that benefited from every atrocity that have ever fallen upon my people, whether they had a hand in it or not. The lesson of the August 4 atrocity is that accepting that the U.S.-French imposed regime means accepting leaders who think nothing of murdering their own citizens. If we allow Lebanon to continue fragmenting, it opens the door to catastrophes of an infinitely greater magnitude than the port explosion. This disaster must be our wake-up call for inaugurating a new Lebanon. There's no salvation for a system that is rotten to the core pushed by Western colonial powers. Our salvation is through collectively banishing those who colluded in Lebanon's downfall and who remain wedded to a medieval and inherently corrupt sectarian system. About 100 years ago, in 1923, Gibran wrote in the Prophet, "You need to know the secret of death. How can you know the secret if you do not know life?" But today, Gibran's Beirut does not know the secret of death as we struggle to decipher the meaning of our lives on this beautiful yet battered piece of land. Welcome to the Middle Stream. I'm Marwa Osman.
A year after the explosion that rocked Beirut on August 4th, 2020, killing 218 people, injuring more than 7,000, and devastating much of the city, the Lebanese investigation into the blast has yielded no credible results. Families of the victims, some of whom are calling for an international investigation, are sadly being beaten by riot police a year after the tragedy for simply demanding the truth about what killed their kids, their mothers, their fathers, their loved ones. A year after the explosion, none of the victims' families in Lebanon have been asked to give witness statements, nor have they received any form of official apology or even been contacted by Lebanese authorities. Families of the victims and every Lebanese citizen wants answers to their many questions. They want to know why the ammonium nitrate was in the port, who ordered it, and what's happened to the rest of it since just 750 tons out of the 2,750 stored there reportedly exploded. Just imagine what would have happened to Beirut and its greater surrounding areas had the 2,750 tons exploded. I can't imagine. We want to know if there were other explosives kept in that port and how the fire that triggered the explosion was started, and whether it was really just a fire or was it an act of terrorism. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is member of the Lebanese Parliament, Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui from the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc Hezbollah. Thank you very much, Dr. Moussaoui, for being with us. A year on, after the largest non-nuclear explosion in history, how do you set the scene post-blast, pandemic-ridden, financially beaten Lebanon?
Well, this is, first of all, thank you for having me on the show.
Pleasure.
What we're about, actually, to talk about now, we're talking about one of the worst catastrophes ever. We're talking here about a disaster that was man-made. Whether it's negligence, whether it's in purpose, whatever the reason is, all of this time that has passed, we're about like two days from now, and we're going to have the first anniversary for this tragedy that happened in Lebanon. We've been waiting, and we continue to wait for the judiciary to come out and to give the victims some tribute, to give their families some answers for the very important questions about what happened. We're not telling them to tell us about the secret issues, the secret side of the investigation. We know very well, and we believe in the secrecy of the investigation that should be kept. It should be classified for one reason or another, because we wanted justice. Justice is what we seek. But still now, there are things that can be told to the people, to the public opinion, to all the Lebanese parties, to all the Lebanese factions, to the international community. And if you know, and we know that for a fact, that the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, has come two times, and he has sought this. He has said that we want the judiciary to come and tell us, the one who is taking the responsibility of the investigation, to come and tell us about the general lines of what happened, general lines of how did this explosion happen. Because you know very well that Hezbollah is being accused by certain parties, and they are investing.
We will talk about that extensively, but Dr. Moussaoui, 218 people died in the Beirut explosion, yet the survivors have been abandoned for slow, torturous deaths, or maybe sickness from hunger, from poverty, from lack of medicine, and from the political turmoil that is possibly yet to come to the country. What has Hezbollah done so far within its jurisdiction as part of the government and as part of the Lebanese parliament as well to ensure justice is to be served at least to the survivors?
Actually, one very important issue, we are not, there is a government and there is a statesmanship. There is a state that should handle the whole matter. You are exactly right. We are part of the government. We are part of the parliament, and we should be responsible one way or another in order to make sure, ensure that justice is going to take its place. To tell you the truth, I am in the Committee of Justice and Administration in the Lebanese parliament, and we have gone through this issue deeply. We have brought opinions, legal opinions from judges, from authorities, some people who have authority over such issues, and they themselves said when we got this appeal from the judiciary that they want the parliamentarians or some MPs who were ministers at the time to come and appear before the court, we have tried as much as we can in order to take a legal decision. No legal conclusion has come to us that the parliament has any evidence or has any premises where they can build upon to present those to the judiciary. That's why the Lebanese parliament has taken the initiative to direct accusations, and in order to later on present a committee that is going to be composed of 8 judges from the Lebanese judiciary, 7 MPs from the Lebanese parliament, and they are going to go into deep investigation for those who are accused of negligence or of whatever.
Why did it take so much time? It's been a year.
Yeah, it's been a year because, to tell you the truth, there has been a problem. You know what happened? There was one judge and then he was replaced by another.
Yes.
And they were like looking into the different evidences or whatever
why,
that are there.
Which brings us to summarizing what's happening right now against Hezbollah, to be specific. Now, the atrocity summarized everything that is rotten about Lebanon's governing system, the corruption, the incompetent inaction, and the politicized judiciary system, which explains why it went to one judge and then to the other. Yet a large group of NGOs that were born directly after that explosion, who are funded by Western powers, are propagating that Hezbollah is behind the blast and that the regime is being held, and I quote, hostage by Hezbollah. Could you please tell us in what sectors are you guys holding the Lebanese regime hostage, if you don't mind me asking?
This is a joke, but no one likes such jokes, actually. When we talk about political things, when we talk about a country that is engulfed in such a huge problems, those people who are doing this, they are trying to mislead the public. They are trying to mislead the whole people in Lebanon and outside, because they are actually covering the face of the true criminal, and they are trying to pinpoint to others who are not responsible. Actually, we have nothing whatsoever to do with what happened. We know this is a political agenda that has been trying to be put into effect through military actions, military operations, military aggressions. We remember this. I mean, this is for all of the public. We should understand that they are trying to get rid of the resistance one way or another. They started and continued this kind of military aggressions by Israel. It didn't work. Then they have the Takfiri groups. It didn't work. Then they came to this issue.
And
we
this is the second time a political accusation has been made against Hezbollah. And I want to talk more about this, Dr. Ibrahim, but we want to go to the second segment where we dive in into the accusations and what can be done to bring justice to people. Please stay with us. Knowing the truth will not bring our victims back. It will not heal out my youngest child, who still jumps in fear anytime there is a thunderstorm, although her face healed. And she now laughs about it, and she says it's a clown nose once she sees it in photographs. She stayed with a clown nose for weeks, and now she calls it the Big Bang. And when Lebanon's ruling elite pay for what they did, maybe we can have a change here in Lebanon and we can live it in a normal country. Lebanese authorities initially promised a swift investigation into the blast, vowing to deliver results within 5 days. Yes, 5 days. But over the past 12 months, the investigation into the biggest crime in Lebanon's history has been marked by little more than obstruction, evasion, and delay. Lebanon running out of political and economic chances in this following report. On August 4th, 2020, a devastating blast in a warehouse destroyed much of the center of the Lebanese capital, Beirut.
Many neighborhoods were destroyed. Downtown Beirut looked like a war zone. Thousands were injured and some 218 people tragically lost their lives on that day and the days that followed. For many, their poverty and livelihoods were literally blown away. The effects of those explosions are still reverberating 1 year later. The country is striving to find a path to emerge from a tragedy that has touched every single person. The destructive fallout of August 4th intensified suffering in Lebanon, which was already reeling from civil unrest, economic and financial hardship, increasing poverty and unemployment, compounded by political deadlock and a soaring number of COVID-19 cases. A year on from this tragedy, there is deepening hardships and mounting frustration. It is clear that the situation of ordinary people in Lebanon is worsening by the day. Currently, the UN estimates that more than 1 million Lebanese out of a population of almost 8 million, including more than 2 million refugees and migrants, need relief assistance to cover their basic needs, including access to food, health, education, and water. Lebanon, which not so long ago was a high middle-income country, is now facing probably the worst financial and economic crisis in its modern history. Over half of its population is living in poverty. It is perhaps not surprising that many people have lost trust in their leaders and institutions. It is regretful that Lebanon's leaders have been unable to reach agreement on the formation of a new government in the past 12 months, which has delayed urgently needed structural reforms to address the country's numerous challenges. This is a critical moment in Lebanon's history. The combined magnitude, depth, and multidimensionality of the political, socioeconomic, and humanitarian crisis facing Lebanon is unprecedented and presents an increasingly challenging landscape for people who still believe that change is possible. Much of the devastation from the blast is still visible. The port resembles a bomb site, and many buildings have been left in a state of collapse. Major questions remain unanswered, including why such a large shipment of ammonium nitrate, a highly explosive chemical used in bombs and fertilizer, was left stored in the middle of a crowded city for years after unloading in 2014. The immunity enjoyed by senior officials has raised suspicions among some families that there may never be accountability. But ultimately, the responsibility for avoiding the total collapse of Lebanon lies primarily in the hands of its leaders, who so far have shown no intention to truly relieve the suffering of the Lebanese population.
Now we continue with member of the Lebanese Parliament, Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui from the Loyalty to the Resistance bloc Hezbollah. Thanks again, Dr. Ibrahim. Now, days ago, it was published in the media by Reuters, to be specific, that the FBI concluded after the blast that the amount of ammonium nitrate that blew up in Beirut port last year was one-fifth of the shipment unloaded there in 2014, adding to suspicions that much of the cargo has actually gone missing. Now, legally speaking, who is responsible for the whereabouts of such a shipment, and where on earth is the remaining part of the ammonium nitrate?
This is a very excellent question. Actually, first, I mean, this tragic event that happened, again, now we are 2 days from now, it will be the first anniversary. The answers are still being sought from the state, from the official side, from the judiciary. If you want exactly who's responsible, here we're talking about who's responsible for the port, for the Beirut port, for the cargo that are there. It's well known, officially, it's the Lebanese army. The Lebanese army is the one who's responsible for the cargo. It's not the general security, because, I mean, it's only responsible for the individuals, not for the cargo or for the goods or whatever.
The other one,
it's the judiciary, because and I'm talking generally, this is in general, but if you go, when the judiciary, when this was reported to the judiciary, the judge, there's a judge who has taken a decision to confiscate this or to put it somewhere with all the reservations to be reserved, the official reservation on it. He is the one responsible, actually, and this has been said, actually, that when it is in the hands of the judiciary, because of the principle of the separation of powers, no one has the right to go and interfere in the work and the action and the function of the judiciary. So here we're talking about the judiciary system that is responsible, and the judge who has taken a decision to put them aside and to have investigation over them.
Why wasn't he brought in to at least ask him a couple of questions?
This is one of the problems, actually. Why we have always called for the, if you want, for the sovereignty of the and the sovereignty and the independence of judiciary in Lebanon, and it has to do with the individuals themselves. To tell you, if you put the best system, if you write the best law, you need someone to put it into effect. Correct. Who do put it into effect? The people, the individuals. So when we talk about the individuals and the people, we are talking about judges. This judge who is responsible, he has not been summoned to be listened to or to hear him. There was no session of hearing. There was nothing. And actually, this is why the Lebanese parliament did not accept, actually, because you did not even do anything about this judge or other one responsible.
Well, this is what I want to ask you about. A probe into the port blast led by Judge Tariq Bitar has been hindered over the past month as requests sent to Parliament and to government, the one that you're talking about, to lift immunity and enable questioning of several top officials. These demands were either declined or they were stalled. Why was it stalled or declined? And what is Hezbollah stands on this, given that we
saw
signatures of MPs, and we need just to understand why.
Well, to tell you, I'm because I am a member of Justice and Administration Committee, I put my signature also on this list, actually, in order to make a list of accusation against the accused or those who thought of people, ministers or whatever. Why did we do that? Because when we got this appeal from Judge Bitar, we sent him a message. We held a meeting. This is the legal way. This is the legal way to do it, actually. Mm-hmm. We went, we brought all of the parliamentary committees in the parliament. We're talking about the Administration and Justice Committee, and we are talking, when you talk about Administration and Justice Committee, all of the Lebanese parties are represented in this. They are presented, and they are represented there. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about all the parliamentary blocks, they were there. When we started to discuss it, and when we heard those who are accused, there was nothing in the appeal. If you want someone to come to you as a judiciary, you should have brought, I'm not talking about evidences, you should bring some premises, something significant to convince us to not lift, as they say, the immunity. It's not a matter of lifting the immunity. What we have in the parliament is that when we have high treason by the ministers or by the president of the republic, we have the right to form a parliamentary committee, or we have the right to make this accusation. Actually, the Judge Bitar himself did not support, he did not supply us with anything in order to put this into effect. And we sent him a message.
So how asking, come they asked to
we sent him? We sent him a message again, and we told him, if you have anything, when we discussed this on the legal side, and all the parliamentary blocs, they were there, and they all accepted what we said, actually.
Then why was Hezbollah specifically targeted?
Because this is the important question. This tells you that this is the agenda. This is the agenda. This is what they wanted to do. We have been targeted because there is a hidden agenda to all of this. They want to accuse the party of different things because they want to mount the pressure from now till the coming elections, and they want to make this kind of wedge between the people and Hezbollah.
So it's purely a legal matter.
It is purely illegal. It's purely political.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm talking the lifting the immunity. It's a legal matter that needs evidence. That's why you did not allow.
Absolutely. I'll tell you what. You know what happened when the judge wanted. They put it into the media. You know, instead of sending it to the accused, to the ministers, to the parliamentarians, whoever they are, they heard it from the news. And you know, this is the public opinion, as we say. This is a kind of propaganda, public opinion. You are mobilizing the people against those persons.
So they are changing
them the
from illegal into a political propaganda.
Exactly.
But Lebanon is at a very decisive
And to tell you the truth, we have asked the judge, please resend us anything that could allow us, and we are ready to make a a meeting at any time in order to lift the immunity, as you said. But
well,
he didn't provide
so
us with anything tangible.
It's now basically in the hands of Judge Bitar and what happens next. But Lebanon is at a decisive crossroad now with Najib Miqati being the new prime minister designated instead of Saad al-Hariri. And people are criticizing his name, especially that Miqati has a responsibility to uphold, since he was prime minister, when the ammonium nitrate entered the Beirut port, and he knows about that. What will Miqati be able to achieve here that Hariri was not? And what is your main concern as Hezbollah for the upcoming political and security reality in Lebanon? We have seen over the past couple of days a huge dive in security.
I'm not in a position to defend Prime Minister designate Miqati or to attack someone else. It's only that we have a way in order to come out of this problem. What is the way? The only way is to have to form a government. Now, who was nominated to this position? You know, when we talk about Lebanon, we talk about the priorities. We have a political system who come into a deadlock. We have a structural deficit. We have structural disorder in the political system itself. Now we are, as just like what you said, in decisive, very sensitive, very crucial position in the economic level, in the political level, on every level. Now, Saad al-Hariri, who was not successful to form the cabinet, he named in the name of the Sunni majority. Let's accept it. We live in a confessional system. Mm-hmm. He named Miqati to this position, and that's why we accepted this, and we have nominated him. We have named him. Why did we do that? Because this is the only way to try to make an attempt to come out of the stalemate of the problem of the crisis.
So hopefully we look forward into forming a government soon enough to try and lift the country from the political and economic challenges it is facing.
We don't say that we don't have problems. We don't say we don't have problems. We don't say that there are no flaws or mistakes. But this is the way that would lead us out, and hopefully we can do it.
Inshallah. Thank you very much, Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, Lebanese Member of Parliament, part of the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc, Hezbollah. Thank you very much for being with us. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East stream.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Aysel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatihul Jinan, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayed Al Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. When we're living in a society, and as we know as human beings, al-insanu madaniyun bi-taba', we, as human beings, we are inclined in our instinct, in our nature, to be social, to want to socialize with others. And therefore, Islam, which is a very social religion, gives us many, many instructions as to how we are able to socialize with others in a healthy way. Having good morals, good manners, will attract love and affection from other people. People will like you. People will say, MashaAllah, he is a very kind person. She is a very well-mannered person. They want to remember you in good. They don't want to say, well, he was always grumpy. She was always rude. He was always arrogant. You know, her tongue was as sharp as a sword. You know, these kind of things, you know, that